Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, April 14th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is 47 degrees and sunny and pleasant, very springy here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Botnets. DOJ, new remote FBI search and seizure powers, and Mitnick, and that would be in reference to Kevin Mitnick, the hacker back from the 90s, who wasn't really a hacker. I was reading a little bit more about Kevin. I hadn't heard his name in so many years, and then we saw that article yesterday about him telling you how to get invisible, take yourself out of the machine. And I went back and hit his wiki, and now I remember all the reasons why Kevin Mitnick was such a hero, because Kevin Mitnick found ways to hack without hacking. Kevin Mitnick used some sorts of social, manipulation to be able to coax people into giving him information that then he utilized to compromise accounts. And, you know, it wasn't that being a criminal is what we were cheering him on for. We were cheering him on for is that he was one of the really very first quote-unquote hackers, and he had found a way to break the system. He had found a way to be a fugitive, and he got away. I think he got arrested at like 13 or 16, you know, one of those little troublemakers. And he spent a year in jail, and then he got out. And then he started social engineering again, and I don't know, he took down or was able to infiltrate a corporate network, and then he went on the run, and he was a fugitive for a few years. And when I was in tech support is when they caught him, 1995, and then he did a whole long stint in jail, and I remember everybody had bumper stickers that said Free Kevin. And that's what that was all about, because the feds had come down really, really hard on him. Like, they were showing an example, Johnny. Don't you do this. Because, look, it, hackers are bad. Hackers are bad. And just like Aaron Schwartz, if you remember, Aaron Schwartz was accused of major copyright infringement. And all he had done was try to make the published studies that a lot of were paid for with a lot of public funding public, instead of making people have to pay for them. And, you know, these studies, these are the types of studies that I cover every day to do research for my show out of things like Nature, the science publication, or some of the many others that are out there. Some of them are free, but some of them they charge for. And that was Aaron Schwartz wanted to make those available to the public, you know, for the global library. And they came at him very hard-handedly with a, sledgehammer. And the poor guy, I mean, I don't know, there were lots of questions around how he died. They said he committed suicide. I mean, it's very possible, or it's very possible he was suicided. But it definitely was before its time. They pushed him. They came down hard on him to make an example. And, it took its toll. Kevin Mitnick, on the other hand, was able to bounce back. And that's why we kind of ended there, because Kevin was sort of a hero. I mean, if you take a look what he's done now, he came back and he won. He got out of jail. They said, you can't touch a computer. And they did. I was reading. The only thing that he was allowed was a landline. He was not allowed, as terms of his probation after he got out, to even touch a computer. But he was able to get permission. He started a consulting firm as a security specialist. And that is still what he was doing. He's writing books and he's giving lectures as well. And social engineering. And what's interesting about that is social engineering is exactly what they're doing now, to try to direct evolution toward this embracing of the machine. It's how they're doing it. They're utilizing peer pressure to make you and your dissent against any new innovation seemed like you're the wrong one. You're the one who has problems in your thinking because the rest of the majority doesn't seem to have a problem with it, Joel. So it must be you. But guys, look, this is beyond a psyop now. All right, the masses have somehow been walled into this, I don't know, ability to just accept things that are, even just a few years ago, were so completely off the rails, so completely outside of our moral fortitude. But now it's okay. You know, I mean, this, even just a few years ago, bombing, what was that bomb they used yesterday? That Moab, mother of all bombs, massively expensive. I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, it's millions of dollars of taxpayer funding wasted on blowing up one bomb. Just one. In some, you know, caves in Afghanistan. Wait, I think we heard that story before. What did we do that for? Couldn't we have used $100 million a little more constructively? I know I could have. You know, if they would have given me $100 million, I probably could have done wonders. And I am a bargain shopper. But instead, we went poof. Might as well have taken a pile of $100 million and just set it on fire. What did that accomplish? I saw last night, late at night, good old CNN propaganda arm and pumped out through my phone that we killed 36 insurgents in the caves of Afghanistan with that, I don't even remember, I saw differing reports on the amount of a Moab one versus the whole group of them. But it was at least around 100, maybe 200, 300 million was the total I think I saw for all of them. But even if it was $100,000, can't you find a better use for $100,000? Like a toilet seat. You know, something. 36 insurgents who weren't doing anything sitting in the caves of Afghanistan. You know, another question. When did we go back to Afghanistan? I know we're still there. But when did it become such a hot spot that we are considering dropping the mother of all bombs out there? Or was that just a test bed? Seems ridiculous to me that we are even wasting our time there. But again, it's all social engineering. It's something that now, you know, a few years ago, especially after the Vietnam War, you remember, people were just horrified. They didn't want any more war. And it has just been endless war in this country. Now let's have more war. War with wars with people who aren't even there. War with empty caves that, I don't know, the Russians were bombing Afghanistan way years before we were. Then they gave up, and then we showed up. And then we said we were going to scale it back, but then we put more people in there. And then, wait, we found a guy on dialysis in a cave, and we dumped him in the ocean. Oh, but there were no pictures. And then we found his porn. I mean, guys, this has just been this game to allow them to justify the military, industrial, academic complex. And I hate to put academic in there because I came from academia. I really enjoyed at least some parts of it. I mean, I met a lot of friends there. We had a lot of fun. You know, when you remind me of college, I think back to how much fun I had in college, but I also learned a lot. I had a lot of friends. But it really is, every time we read a story about any of these new technologies, not that mother of all bombs was a new technology, it was just lots of explosives, but all these laser weapons and disintegration beams and this crap that they're working on now, this is being done in these same universities that I went and got my English degree in. This is being done in these same universities that we have found memories of. They've taken these universities, they've making them money hungry, they've making them technology centers. You know, here in New York, they're doing the same thing. There's all these economic development zones now where you can come in and we'll give you all kinds of tax-free office space as long as you hire a bunch of people and bring your headquarters here. We'll give it to you 10, 20 years, tax-free. Come on in. And you can tie up your operations with our universities and get access to some of the brightest minds in New York. And, I mean, they do that, too. They don't want a brain drain because that happened for a long time. There were no jobs. We all got a good education at a decent university for a good price, but there were no jobs here, so everyone started hitting the road. And New York became one of the biggest welfare states out there. If you look, New York State has awesome bennies. If you're poor, if you're a single mother, if you are divorced and have a kid and want to go back to school and you don't have health insurance or can pay your rent or any of that other stuff or your heat or whatever, step right up because there's a whole package for you. And what has happened is, as we have this welfare state that is blossoming, this military industrial academic complex that is blossoming, we've set the stage now for our economic engine. I mean, it used to be a small facet, but now it almost seems like our economic engine is the war machine. 21st century technologies that can kill people. Or, hey, wait a minute. Don't forget about it, Jewel. We also have the medical industrial complex for 21st century. And see, it's almost like the yin and the yang. It is the double-edged sword of technology. Now, the 21st Century Cures, as they're calling them, part of the 21st Century Cures Act, all these biotech companies chomping at the bit, they want to get a piece of the pie. And that is the piece of the pie that we were talking about yesterday. The piece of the pie that helps find all of the chinks in the human armor, all in the name of curing you. Again, it's always to keep us safe, whether it's from disease or from insurgents. But to keep us safe from disease, they need to be able, and they've said this many, many times, they need to be able to monitor us in a dashboard, you know, just like your car. Get in your car, you see a little dashboard, you see all the dummy, not even the dummy lights, we have dummy gauges. They want to be able to tell whether or not your temperature's getting hot before it's 105. They want to know whether or not there is some deterioration in your processing of bodily waste before there is a problem. And I can absolutely see how. I mean, on paper, theoretically, that seems to be a great idea. They want to see whether or not, remember, mental illness isn't black and white. It occurs on a spectrum. Now, that was good old Tommy Insow. We talked about him, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, the guy who wants to get rid of the DSM and diagnose mental disease on a spectrum. Now, do I think that mental disease could potentially be on a spectrum? Yes. Actually, Camille, one of my listeners, hi Camille, good morning, sent me something about the history of the DSM. I know a lot of that diagnostic statistical manual was based on faulty science from even back in the, I don't remember if it was the 1800s or the early 1900s for like schizophrenia. And it ended up that there may have been all kinds of other diseases that were behind this. I think that's what it was. But, I mean, I'm reading about this quote-unquote illness now. And this is something that's of personal interest to me because when I was a kid, I used to get strep throat a lot. But there's something now diagnosed called PANS, P-A-N-S, or PANDAS is another name for it. And they're discovering these personality disorders, not even disorders, disturbances with like oppositional defiant disorder, not being able to follow directions, and being snotty all the time. I know there are all these behavioral things, but I suffered from a lot of those. And when I was 18, by the time I got to be 18, my mother, father, and I did not get along. And I was like, see ya. And they're like, don't let the door hit you in the ass. And I'm sure that happens to most of us, but I was one of those kids growing up. I must have had strep throat probably 20 times. And they would give me the antibiotics. And, you know, kids are bad at taking medications, and I wouldn't have to take my antibiotics. And then I get it again, and then I get it again. And I really think that it caused me some issues. I found out in my physical for college then after that I had this weird little heart murmur, and no one had ever found that before. And then years later, when I was pregnant, I don't remember if it came back. I think it might have come back, but it'd been gone for 20 years then between there. But anyway, when I started looking it up, whatever this was, oh, I know what it was. It was a little valve now. It doesn't quite close all the way, and it allows it to back leak or something. And the doctor told me that a lot of times they see that, and it comes from rheumatic fever, like rheumatic fever. And then I went back in my history, and yes, it was diagnosed as mono. I am pretty sure it was actually rheumatic fever, and it would explain why years later I never showed up before the antibody of mono. But it comes from not properly treating strep throat. Well, I find this syndrome, PANS or PANDAS, whatever you want to call it, either or, that is this whole list of insane symptoms that they have now discovered is tied. These neurological symptoms, they can give you issues on a spectrum. They can give you tics and OCD. And I actually remember when I was a teenager, all of a sudden, getting really, really superly anally retentive about logging exactly what clothes I wore every day. I hit this chart. Guys, you know what? This should have been a red alarm. Thinking about it now and reading through this stuff, and I was like, wow, you know, I used to just laugh that I was anally retentive and I just like things exactly the way I like them. But no, I think this strep throat got me. This PANDAS stuff. I want to show this to my mother because this is the first time I've ever seen this. But I distinctly remember when I was about 14 getting very, very, very meticulous about what I wore. I couldn't wear the same thing in the same week. I couldn't even wear like the same socks or the same jeans. And I wrote everything down, what shirt I wore, what pants I wore. And I was like tracking them. And then I would go through and make sure, well, maybe I could go 2 weeks without wearing the same thing. And it was insane. It was a complete waste of time. It was a very nice spreadsheet. But why did that matter so much? Because it doesn't. When I look now at the grand scheme of things, like, how ridiculous is that? But I really think it was a case of OCD. That's exactly what it is, obsessive compulsive disorder. And I joke about having OCD. I'm OCD over being clean at times. I get my spaz out, and my house has to be clean. But that's because it makes my brain short circuit. But listen to this. This isn't where I was going to get, but I'm going to, at least for people who've never seen this, I'll drop a link to it. I wanted to at least mention it because for people who have kids who have some issues following direction, and if your kids have ever had strep throat or any type of streptococcal infection, it might really be worth looking into. I also saw sinus infections. If you can believe it, now again, sinus infections is something else I used to get a lot when I was a kid. Sinus infections and the swelling of all of those pathways in the head, all around the nose, the sinus cavities, and up and around in the brain, literally cause swelling in the brain. And there is an entire three tables here that go into different types of neuropsychiatric symptoms that different types and different levels of sinusitis have been shown to cause in children. And this was with a pretty big study group. And I'm really freaking out. I mean, if literally our health is this tedious that even a stuffy nose, like right now, we're all kind of stuffy. People are all suffering from the pollen explosions that are happening everywhere. It got warmish and sunny today, so it feels like a spring day, which means that yes, my nose is drippy and my throat is tickly. But if there are all kinds of different symptoms that this very issue can cause, and Not just in children. I mean, this was been seen in children, but I am certain we all share the same biology, so why wouldn't it apply to adults as well? It can cause mood and emotional issues, sensory abnormalities, OCD symptoms, anxiety, panic episodes, irritability, aggression, attention difficulties, motor hyperactivity, light sensitivity. I mean, I can't even believe this stuff. So anyway, long story short, we are part of a large system, and even the smallest anomaly or change in that system can affect the other parts of the system greatly. Humans are a part of that system. And if they try to manipulate and change nature, which, you know, I mean, nature is pollen, but maybe we're sensitive to pollen because we don't live outside anymore. We've been desensitized. You know, maybe the glyphosate in our diet, even if we try to get around it, you still get glyphosate in your diet. I can guarantee you. Maybe the glyphosate in our diet is what is making us more sensitive to these things that never bothered us before. I don't even remember having allergies or issues with pollen at some point in the past, but I sure do now. So anyway, how do we get from Kevin Mitnick to pans and pollen allergies? I do not know, but let's go through what we talked about yesterday. So we were talking about the encroaching surveillance state. We were covering how, because of botnets, quote unquote, you know, those botnets that come from places like the Russian hackers, blah, blah, you know, and I mean, they could have come from Eastern Bloc. They could have been organized crime. Yes, yes, they could have. Or they could have been some sort of hack for sale that someplace like the hacky team discovered some vulnerability. And Cyber Patrol, remember, we have all these different divisions now of Cyber Patrol, all tied to the military armed forces, into all the big police agencies and the alphabet agencies that are all now making a living on keeping you safe and trying to find the terrorists and the hackers under every bed and in every closet. And if you're afraid, you just keep paying those tax dollars and hoping that they keep you safe with their new 21st century tools. Well, guys, we've gotten to a point now where the surveillance state is upon us, upside down and sideways. Everything we do, everything we've been doing for a very long time, has been selling us to the machine. We've been talking about the death of the smartphone. The smartphone was kind of really our first step to this dopamine carrot, this surveillance device that we willingly carry with us 24/7. That has little microphones and cameras, and we've given up all permission to privacy when we carry one of these things, GPS connectivity. It finds us everywhere. But now we add to that all the other different gadgets that are in our homes and in our cars, connected via 24/7 wireless, soon to be 5G, ubiquitous internet in the sky, even on the continent of Africa. But guys, we can go back. I found a story last night. This Electron Commerce was asking me some very good questions, and I'll get to those. Sorry. We've been kind of busy. Vacation for the kids started after school yesterday. So it's already been a little zippity-zappity-brained here. But I'll try. Those are very good questions. I'm going to answer everybody on YouTube this next week, I promise. And I will be not doing shows next week, just so you know. I have a couple interviews scheduled, probably Jeff Wefferson. I told Jeff we're going to try and catch up next week, and we're going to talk about frequencies, military radar, whales and cetaceans, which, remember, they are mammals, and how that affects them under the ocean, because this is the same VLF waves we've been talking about. And then we're going to do an interview with April Broden. April is in a new documentary with Ty Bollinger on vaccines and some of the things that they've found. And April herself is in the documentary, so she wanted to talk about that. That actually kicked off Wednesday, I believe, this week. There is a free screening for the next 5 weeks or something. There's five parts of it. I have asked her to please post each day on UCY's Facebook page. That feeds out to twitter.com/UCYTV. So you can find that there if you want to catch those. After that, they will be selling DVDs, but it is a free screening for the next few weeks in pieces. But anyway, I found a story getting back to surveillance. And we've known that they've been watching for a very long time, right? We've known that they've had CCTV everywhere. I think Europe was even maybe a little ahead of the United States at the time. But don't worry about it. We're catching up. We're spending those taxpayer dollars like they're going out of style. For 2010, Scientific American, March 30th, so just over 7 years back, look sharp, video search engine helps monitor criminals, employees, and consumers alike. Now, you remember, we read a story about the FBI database of facial recognition software and images that they have. We found out that there are like millions and millions of Americans in that FBI database that have never done anything wrong. They've got their faces in there because they were standing next to someone, or their name sounded like someone else, or maybe they were in some conversation with 12 people removed from someone who was under investigation. But hey, they got swept up. We were talking about this yesterday, and all that data, shoop, just like Trump, they say, in the Russian investigation, just got swept up in the mass surveillance and put into the records. Well, just like that, they have been using these CCTV cameras, which now live on smart lampposts and things all over the city. You have little surveillance cameras in your traffic signals and street lights and from Argus drones up above, 24/7 surveillance in an area that they can even go hit rewind and see what you did over the last week or month. That's just insane. And couple that with all the other data that is being collected from all the other pinpoints now around your day, and you have somebody watching if they want everything you do. Soon you're going to have smart toilets, and then you won't be able to do that in private either. They already have those in Japan. We looked at those the one day. Smart toilets for Nana. All right. So from March 30th, 2010, Scientific American, look sharp. Video search engine helps monitor criminals, employees, and consumers alike. 3VR wants to be the Google of surveillance footage, giving businesses the ability to search video for certain people, places, or things. Businesses? Yes. Now, when we started looking at these fingerprint scanners on your snack machines at work and the peer pressure getting you to sign up so you can get discounts on your health insurance through work, and you and all your coworkers are going to compete against each other to see who can get healthier faster. But you're going to let them track your blood pressure, your snack purchases, and you're going to give a blood sample for a DNA swab to get your discount on your health insurance. Guys, you don't know who's getting that data, where that data is going, how they're tracking you, what it's going to be used for in the future. It's being added to that big, bloated dossier that every single one of us already have, because it's been going on for probably 20 years at least from the consumer perspective, but probably even longer for some of us who maybe, you know, were bucking the system even earlier than that. And I don't know, an environmental protester probably didn't end up on too many bulletin boards with red darts on their heads. But I don't know, we used to lay in roads and protect trees in the forest and that back in the early 90s and the late 80s. So hopefully well, there were guys too with these reflecty sunglasses and a walkie-talkie up their sleeve that used to come. So I don't know. But, you know, it makes you wonder, like, I really, before there was this thing about sending a freedom of information request to the feds to get your file And I remember a bunch of people wanted to do that. And I really wanted to do that to see what garbage they have on me. I mean, I'm probably one of the most harmless people on the planet. I just talk a lot, do a lot of research. My brain maybe isn't harmless. My brain thinks about a lot of things, but I'm not pretty harmless. I mean, I'm all for being good and, you know, let's just be friends. Let's enjoy ourselves. And let's postulate the possibilities, good and bad. Well, that's what I'm about. I'm a thinker. I'm a thinker. But I could just imagine, like, some of the crazy stuff that they could have. And when we start looking at now all these technologies that we find out have been in use since the 90s with this morphing, voice morphing, video morphing, imaging morphing, they could make us say or do anything if they wanted to. If they really wanted to set somebody up, they really wanted to blackmail somebody, they really wanted to do something, they could make you say or do anything. And if not in person, they couldn't coerce you to do it in front of a camera. They probably could get enough footage or audio to make you say or do whatever they want. And it's so disturbing to me that we're at that point in time now. Is now we're putting AI behind a lot of this stuff. We're going to let AI run the show. We're going to put AI behind allocating the RF frequency spectrum, we found out as well, and mayhem to be the sentry of the internet to keep you safe from hackers, patch all those holes, and surveil what's going on. We found out yesterday as well the FBI got new powers in November that allowed them remote search and seizure. That could be given warrant permission from any judge in any state across the United States, and you could be swept up in one of those surveillance tags without your knowledge and without doing anything wrong at all. It's all right. Well, I'm smelling something that smells like burning wood. I can't tell if that's in here. Well, I'll let you know if I see flames in a few minutes. How weird. I hope that's outside and someone's burning logs. All right. So anyway, digital video surveillance has become a staple of security systems used by banks, supermarkets, and other businesses in the past few years because the technology produces better quality video that is easier and cheaper to archive than tapes. Now, remember, guys, this was 7 years ago. But I want you to understand how far they already were 7 years ago. And now we add the law of exponential returns. And think about just the technologies we've talked about over the last few years. And you start to go, whoa. Technology's Achilles heel, however, has been its rudimentary search capabilities that use video timestamps to help locate specific footage. Well, this is changing. 7 years ago, as technology companies pour resources into making video search engines that they hope will do for surveillance, what Google, Yahoo, and other search engines have done in making the web's vast resources more accessible. Now, there was a company, maybe in 2012, 2013, that was able to search like a million images in a minute. And we're talking facial recognition images. And what they ended up doing was taking a 230-point facial recognition and start applying it to video. So now take a step forward. So then we had a story about being able to tell whether or not you are a potential criminal by looking in video at your gait and how you walked and what your facial expressions were. And remember, this started getting into this personality and behavioral profiling that we've talked about so many times here. This is something that not only are they using for law enforcement, but they're using it for psychological assessment as well. And as you start getting Tommy Insel, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, working for Google, now working on how to diagnose quote unquote mental diseases, because since apparently mental diseases, like I said, the definition is going to keep expanding on this now. We started with Alzheimer's and dementia and all of these different deteriorating brain diseases that seem to be epidemic now. Well, now it's moved beyond that. Parkinson's as well. Now oppositional defiant disorder and this pandas and all these other things. And whether or not you're a criminal or a genius or a bingo player, if you remember that too, they could tell that from just your bodily movements and your face as well. The capture and analysis of surveillance footage has been an indispensable tool for who? Oh, the U.S. counterterrorism and law enforcement of the past decade since 9/11. It can be programmed to identify certain patterns and colors and issue security alerts when it sees these characteristics in the video. But terrorists and criminals change their tactics and slip through security that the surveillance was designed to stop or catch. So with video analytics, a team at NYU has homed in on motion capture. And remember, New York City was a big, big research pot after 9/11. Where they've started experimenting with a lot of the surveillance technology, as well as biosensors in the case of any type of bioterror attack. The team at New York University has homed in on motion capture as a particularly promising approach to analysis. Person's body moves differently when it must compensate for some unnatural burden like a heavy backpack or even high-heeled shoes. And Movement Labs, which is a motion capture studio and research group housed at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. Oh, I've been there 1.5 million times. That's very strange. And when a person's weighed down by a backpack, his or her feet will strike the ground with greater force than otherwise. They have identified certain movement signatures with the help of the same motion capture technology that is being used in special effects for Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. Reflective markers placed at various locations on these special motion capture suits can be picked up by a series of cameras. Outside the lab, however, the real world poses problems for motion capture research. There simply are not enough motion capture suits for everyone to wear, right? Don't worry about it, guys, because they'll find a way around that one, because I'm sure DARPA's involved, and yes, they are. Briglers, motion analysis research has attracted the attention of who? Oh, the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, in the year 2000. So again, this is 17 years ago. Is it possible means of identifying security threats? And then, of course, 9/11 happened just a little while later. And his research was ramped up thanks to funding from the National Science Foundation and the Office of Naval Research. Law enforcement and counterterrorism organizations already had facial recognition technology, but they were looking for additional ways as well to make better sense of countless hours of surveillance footage. So don't worry about it, because we are just starting with intrinsic biometrics. So estimating from the past, it will probably take 5 or so years for it to become as accurate as facial recognition and other biometrics. And guys, this was from September 27th, 2011. So now let's fast forward 6 years. It was CCTV. Then it was facial recognition and gate cameras being able to tell maybe if you look suspicious. But now we've come to 2017. Workplace surveillance is the new office perk. We started the story twice now, and we're going to get through it today. And I can't even believe another hour is almost gone. This is just unbelievable. I can't seem to get as far as I want to get. Americans are offering up more and more personal data at work. And it's not just at work, people. It's everywhere. Every bit of your data is being leaked out every minute of the day. Personal information about you that is going to be used against you at some point in the future if somebody ever wanted to. I'm not saying, I'm just saying, the more and more and more and more and more you put out there, the more and more and more and more and more there is against you. You know, we're not all little angels, and maybe you say or do things that maybe somebody doesn't like even. Maybe it's not that it isn't wrong, just someone doesn't like it. Just careful what you say and do. it's going to get much, much harder to opt out as well. And so we found out Alice has to use her fingerprint if she wants to get a snack at work. And she either can use her fingerprint or her biometric ID card. Either way, they're going to be tracking what she buys, like the Snickers in the machine. And that information is given to a third party, but she doesn't know who, she doesn't know where, and she doesn't know what that data is going to be used for. You know, maybe tracking snacks isn't a big idea, but all of her coworkers are also wearing these Fitbits, and they are having competitions about who can do the most steps. We talked about that many times, Fitbits, how this is, again, another big psyop to get healthy. You know, you're just going to be the dangling, you're going to follow that dangling carrot of getting healthy right down into the pits of somebody later telling you, you cannot eat that, Dave. It is not good for you. I mean, this is where we're headed. But considering all her colleagues are wearing Fitbits and their data is also being sent to third-party companies contracted by her employer, or that considering that once a year they're required to get a full blood workup, again, through another third party, and Alice, if she opts out, she has to pay more to get health insurance then, but she's not sure where any of this data is going and whether or not even her employer knows about any of it. She says everything seems like a black box. I am mostly just confused because no one seems to even bat an eyelash at this 24/7 surveillance of everything they do. And everyone signs up for the blood tests. And a significant portion of these people are walking around with their fitness trackers. She called her office a panopticon. Now that's where we wanted to get to, is what is the panopticon? Maybe that's where we're going to end it today. It is a structure built for total surveillance. That is the type of society that we are moving into. The 21st century is going to be the ultimate panopticon. Every, you know, we've taken these baby steps, and like I said, the CCTV cameras were a big deal way back when, and then everyone kind of got used to them, and then we had, you know, facial recognition, and everyone kind of got used to it, and now it's no big deal. Now you want to give 24/7 real-time data of your biometric processes. All is, you know, keeping us safe, keeping us healthy. It's the way it's going to keep your medicine costs down. It'll allow us to give health insurance to millions of people who never had it before. But all you got to do is give up all your personal information and your habits and your sleeping and your eating and every single thing else. And we'll tell you what to do. We'll tell you if it's good or bad. You don't even have to think about it. And you can get rid of all responsibility for being unhealthy because we'll make you healthy. Otherwise, you will be a useless eater. Whether through voluntary, and we're going to use peer pressure to do it, whether through voluntary, quote unquote, corporate wellness programs, smart badges that record voices and GPS locations. We used to have a smart badge years ago when I was working in tech support. It had RFID, and you just bing, 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 and some badges had access to some labs and some didn't. And we saw that company in Norway now that they are injecting all their employees that want them with RFID chips right in their hand. So now they don't even need smart badges anymore. It's right in the chip in their hand. They can just wave it wherever and have their superpowers. But record voices, GPS locations, surveillance applications in their mobile phones and their personal computers. Americans are offering up more and more personal data at work. And there was something that one of the listeners had asked me in chat. It was about tracking software in the workplace and how people don't necessarily realize that every single thing they do in the office is tracked. And, you know, when I was still working in the office, I've been out of the office for a long time. I worked from home for about 13 years. Still connected via VPN to the office, but thank God I didn't have to sit in the office, and the IT guy was my friend, so I got liberties that others did not get at times. But, you know, the thing is, when you're sitting in an office, you got to worry as a manager whether or not your intellectual property is going to walk out that door, whether or not your lifeblood of your company, the way you do things, your processes and procedures, your products, if you have patents on some of your inventions, your intellectual property is what differentiates you from your competition. And so that is a very important asset. So, you know, back in the days, we used to have antivirus, right? Antivirus is kind of the one big thing that we did at a corporate level. And then it came encryption and, you know, then other things on top of that. But antivirus was the thing that really kind of kicked it off for corporate surveillance. And before that, everybody was just a node on the network. And if you brought in devices from home and plugged them in, no one really knew until one of your devices from home caused some sort of IP address conflict or whatever on the network. And the IT administrator went, beep, beep, beep. What are you plugging in there? Or maybe they got a virus from somewhere on the outside and didn't know where and tied that to your unauthorized device that you plugged into the network. But regardless, you had antivirus software, and companies such as Symantec was a biggie. That was the one that we used. That ended up coming out with this central management system where you had a server and then you had endpoints. And every one of your devices, your PCs, your mobile devices, anything that would be running that would be connecting to that corporate network, including your IP phones or whatever, had some sort of endpoint software on it that you could make certain had all the updates, had all the updated signatures for viruses, and it could keep your network safe. But it appears that that has now blossomed into this full-blown panopticon on the corporate network that not only is watching every keystroke you make, and they probably do have key loggers that's not hard to install, so they can even get all your passwords. You know, when you work at a company, you have a computer user agreement that should be a part of your employee package. And if you read that very, very, very carefully, you're going to find out that every single thing you do on the computer at work is legally, according to the agreement that you are a part of by just working there, they are legally able to read and see and watch every single thing you do. So anybody who thinks they're being cool or slick willy, going on Facebook and typing their friends' messages saying, I hate this job, oh my God, it sucks so bad, guess what? Your employer probably knows that now as well. It's insane. So I don't want to get off the topic, though. I just wanted to point out that this has not been just like a smack in the face that just happened. This has been a very slow progression everywhere across the board. And now, as this whole quote-unquote hackers under every bed thing kind of happens, go back to like Sony Pictures in North Korea. Remember they pulled Kim Jong-un's goons out a while ago and made them the boogeyman, too. We have used this as this motivating factor to make cybersecurity our biggest national concern. And because everybody is so poor at patching holes in software applications that groups such as the hacking team were exploiting and then selling to governments and law enforcement alike across the globe, because you were so bad at patching those holes there, network administrator, we are now going to make certain that those holes don't exist anymore. We are bringing all the big tech boys into the fold, into the security, national security fold of the country. So all the big boys, even though they say that they aren't watching you and surveilling you, we've given them a CYA pass. As long as they just keep handing us the data, we'll make sure you're safe. They launched Mayhem, Carnegie Mellon, DARPA, Grand Challenge, Cyber Grand Challenge last summer. I had a $2 million prize out there for anyone who could develop an artificially intelligent sentry for the internet that would be able to take care of all these issues. DARPA Dan, nobody is safe on the internet, he says. And it is going to apply not only to applications, but to our self-driving cars and to our smart homes and, oh, to the full Internet of Things that is coming that will include you and me and our little neural dust implants that'll be the Fitbit of the nervous system. You know, they talk about that. There's a story there. One of the University of California's and DARPA are building, I think it was Berkeley, are building this neural dust for your nervous system. to be able to track you, bag you, tag you, and keep you safe and healthy 24/7. Guys, it is coming. It has now gotten to the point where it is beyond invasive. Everything you do, everything you say, no matter where you are, at home or at work, is being watched by someone. So anyway, Alice is describing her office, and I'm going to, like I said, extend that to the whole world now as a panopticon, which is a structure built for total surveillance. Your office may be one too, whether through voluntary corporate wellness programs, smart badges that record voices and GPS location, or surveillance apps in their mobile phones and personal computers. Americans are offering up more and more personal data at work, and most of them don't have much of an idea where this data goes or how it'll be used, and there aren't many limits on what employers can find out about their employees or what they can do with that data once they have it. And the more people who opt in now, guess what, Johnny? The harder it will be for you because of peer pressure to opt out in the future. And this isn't me, this is the article saying it is about to get much worse. In January of 2017, new rules went into effect allowing third-party wellness companies to share much more medical data with employers. Ding, ding, ding. And a bill currently moving through Congress would make it legal for employers to force workers. Now, we had postulated this was coming, but I did not know there was a bill. But here it comes, people, to force workers to share their entire DNA sequence, taking employee scrutiny to a previously illegal level while allowing companies to punish workers who do not comply. The short story is surveillance is increasing and the capability to do surveillance is increasing as well. Wellness programs are perhaps the most common way for employers to gain access to their workers' intimate data, and these programs have flourished over the last few years after a clause in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, raised the limit on how much companies could offer in incentives. And, you know, something that is very interesting, right in the middle of all of this, a story came out the other day. If you remember, we've talked about 23andMe, the woman who runs it, the ex-wife of Sergey Brin, head of Google. 23andMe had gotten shut down a year, maybe 2 years ago, in regards to selling genetic testing that could help diagnose genetic diseases. And they were giving profiles saying, oh, look, you have a BRCA gene, and you have this gene and that gene, which could potentially make you more inclined to get a disease than others who do not have that gene. And the FDA said, hey, you can't do that. You aren't a medical establishment. You can't go diagnosing people for $29.95 on their smartphone. And they put a kibosh on it. Well, guess what, guys? It just got approved. At-home genetic test for 10 diseases gets its first FDA approval. And guys, don't fall for this. Do not fall for $29.95 to get your genome sequenced to find out if you are related to the Queen of England, because it's all a trick. We discovered that the National Institute of Health and 23andMe have partnered up as part of this All of Us program, which formerly was the, I don't even remember what it was called, some sort of cohort program, to create a genetic database of a million individuals that then will be used for research and development. Check that box to give them access. 23andMe then spun off another corporation to utilize that same DNA data to create 21st century drugs for free using your data to make bazillions of dollars. They're using the DNA data to find all the chinks in the human armor that they will be able to exploit in the future. Do not give it up. So, all right, here's a story about this 23andMe, April 6th, so this is from a week and a half ago, you'll be able to test yourself at home for a genetic predisposition for certain diseases thanks to a new ruling from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. On Thursday, the FDA gave 23andMe permission to market its personal genome service genetic health risk test for 10 diseases. It is the very first direct direct-to-consumer genetic test that the FDA has allowed to provide information. Now, as you're stepping right up and you're giving up that cheek swab to find out whether or not you got a BRCA gene and whether or not you're related to the Queen of England, I brought something up a long time ago, and I'm going to bring it up again. This is back when Obamacare was first passed. We found out about this. Here's the story. This one's a little bit later, February 17, 2016. There is a loophole, people, about discrimination. If you want to get life insurance, think twice before giving up a genetic test. As genetic testing is exploding, health insurers are banned from denying you coverage based on the results. Like, we're not going to give you health insurance because you got a BRCA gene, but the same does not apply for life insurance. Jennifer Marie, which is not a real name, should be an ideal candidate for life insurance. She's 36, gainfully employed, and has no current medical issues. But on September 15th last year, Jennifer Marie's application for life insurance was denied. Quote, unfortunately, after carefully reviewing your application, we regret to be able to provide you with life insurance coverage because of your positive BRCA1 gene, the letter reads. Now, guess what? And she actually provided the letter to Fast Company, who was writing this story. According to recent estimates, 55 to 65% of women who inherit BRCA1 will develop breast cancer. So, guys, you know what? A lot of people might have that gene. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. But since 2008, with the passing of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, more affectionately known as GINA, federal government has barred health insurance companies from denying coverage with that gene mutation, but the law does not apply to life insurance companies, long-term care companies, or disability insurance companies. These companies can ask about health, family history, genetic information, and reject those who are too risky. So back to this first story. So now we have companies that are demanding access to genetic data for their employees, or we might not give you health insurance. Guys, you might not get life insurance, disability insurance, or a lot of other things if you do that. 2013, Congress funded a study by the RAND think tank and found half of all organizations with 50 or more people have already had wellness programs.
This is Ozzy Skateboard, and you're listening to UCY.TV.